This is KJZZ, your news and information station in Phoenix and across Arizona. I'm Bridget Dowd. Here are this week's stories you don't want to miss. It's the podcast designed to catch you up on some highlights from around the region. Thanks for listening. Here are a few of the stories for the week of September 8th, 2025. State officials are remaining tight-lipped about how an Arizona inmate used fake court documents to secure his release from prison 20 years early. But public records, social media posts, and one tipster have shed light on how David Kramer duped both court officials and the prison system. From KJZZ's politics desk, Wayne Shutsky reports.
On June 16th, Hazel McQueen posted on TikTok that her father was finally getting out of prison.
I have been fighting for my dad to get out of prison. Because he was wrongfully convicted of kidnapping my sister and my brother 13 years ago.
In the post, which is no longer available online, McQueen, who also goes by Haven, says she was on the way to pick up her father.
I've been fighting at the court, filing papers, and right now I'm on my way to the prison to go pick up my dad. After serving DOC, Department of Corrections, with his release order that I got a judge to sign.
But the documents ordering David Kramer's release were fake, according to an order issued by a Maricopa County Superior Court judge at the end of August. Last month, State Prison Director Ryan Thornell told lawmakers that the prison released Kramer in June, even though he isn't scheduled to be released until 2047. Thornell says the release was due to
a lot of fraud, manipulation, other things that took place.
According to a press release from the Department of Corrections, the error was due to fraudulent documentation uploaded to the court docket and received by the department. Those illegitimate documents, obtained by KJZZ before they were sealed by the court, were designed to look like official court orders, but they included some discrepancies, including fonts and formatting that don't match those on official orders issued by the court. And the filing ordering Kramer's release included a signature of his daughter's name, Haven McQueen, on a line listed for deputy clerk, even though she doesn't work for the clerk's office. Governor Katie Hobbs says prison officials and law enforcement worked to rearrest Kramer as soon as they discovered the fraudulent filings.
As soon as we found out about it, we took action. He's back in custody. I'm very happy to report that.
But they aren't disclosing how they found out about the error or how Kramer was able to remain free for 2 months.
So this is a multi-agency issue. He was able to get these forged documents into the court system, directing the department to release him.
A source told KJZZ News that they tipped off law enforcement after discovering similar fraudulent documents in an unrelated child custody case filed by a woman identified as Haven McQueen. KJZZ is not naming the source to avoid disclosing information about that case. A Maricopa County judge ultimately invalidated the questionable filing in the custody proceeding, but the source said they became alarmed when they learned of Kramer's release. They contacted the clerk of the court to obtain a copy of Kramer's release order. When the clerk responded that there was no such order, the source sent an email on August 15th to the Maricopa County Attorney, Arizona Attorney General, and FBI, detailing their suspicions. 5 days later, law enforcement rearrested Kramer on August 20th. Thornell, the prison director, told lawmakers.
Mr. Kramer is in our custody. He's actually at Browning Unit in maximum security because we're treating it as if it was the same logic as an escape.
Kramer's release and rearrest was unknown to the public until State Representative Kevin Payne asked Thornell about it during that hearing in August. Neither Thornell nor Hobbs explicitly blamed the court system for the problem, but
this was a forged document that was uploaded into the court system. Not a document that originated with the department, and the department followed what they thought was an accurate directive. So I don't think any of this is acceptable. We're working to fix it.
A spokesman for the Maricopa County Clerk of Superior Court declined to comment on how the fake documents fooled court officials, but said the court system, attorney general, and prison officials are investigating. Hobbs says that investigation is ongoing.
And we're looking across the systems to see where to ensure that that doesn't happen in the future.
A review by KJZZ News found that Kramer's daughter may have filed other fraudulent court documents on his behalf, including an order supposedly ordering Walgreens to pay Kramer $24 million to settle a lawsuit filed in 2012 related to his arrest earlier that year. Like the other document, it includes a signature for Haven McQueen, claiming she is a deputy clerk. Wayne Shutsky, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Arizona's real estate market has changed dramatically since a 2016 state law that seized local control of most short-term rentals, or STRs, typically used by online travel marketplaces like Airbnb. Back in 2023, we introduced you to a group of Scottsdale residents who felt powerless against the disturbance and harassment from partying transients occupying neighboring homes.
Constant noise, constant rotation of strangers.
A backyard full of 10 extremely drunk, screaming adults.
We've had people trying to enter our home at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Today, KJZZ's Phil Latzman revisits some of those residents to find out if anything has changed.
How are you? Good to see you again.
We met at one of Old Town's oldest and most famous restaurants, Los Olivos, where short-term rentals aren't such a bad thing for business.
It's a great thing, especially being in downtown Scottsdale. My son has a house close to here and it rents out all the time.
That's owner Maria Corral, whose parents opened the area's first Mexican restaurant in 1947.
Yeah, it's great, but everybody in Scottsdale knows how much it's changed here. I mean, it's different. We're the Beverly Hills of Arizona, which is kind of weird. I remember when the streets were dirt.
But that change has accelerated in recent years, especially in the real estate market, after the state changed its rules restricting local control of short-term rentals.
We're here, unfortunately, to send off our friend Cheryl. She is a resident of Old Town Scottsdale and is moving.
That's Kate Bauer, whose organization, the Arizona Neighborhood Alliance, has been trying to unify residents in an effort to stop the proliferation of STRs. And Cheryl Triplett is the one being sent off.
We would have stayed. Scottsdale has changed so much. There's more short-term rentals on our street than there are residents. It just seems that Scottsdale caters to the tourists and tourism. And we can't live like that anymore.
Triplett told us 2 years ago she'd suffered property damage, excessive noise, and that her family had been frequently harassed by drunken and disorderly visitors staying nearby.
Did you ever get anything from the city, from the state, anything at all in terms of help for what you were going through?
No, nothing. I don't feel like the residents have a voice. I never felt like I was represented. Nobody gave us any support.
Fellow Old Town resident Christy Hudson says she feels the problem is only getting worse.
They know the police aren't going to do anything if it's prior to 10 p.m. So the daytime noise has gotten considerably worse.
Hudson says she doesn't buy the theory that Scottsdale's growth as a tourist destination is fueling the rise of STRs.
Scottsdale's always been a tourist destination. Scottsdale never struggled as a tourist destination prior to the Airbnb craze. So why can't people go back to staying at hotels and resorts?
We also met Stephanie Leslerue back in 2023. She says she still feels trapped.
I tried to sell my house. No one was interested. We're just staying put for right now. But I mean, I don't have loyalty to the neighborhood. I've kind of given up on the police.
Leslerue says she's had to put off major life decisions because of her housing predicament.
I did move there because it was a very family-oriented neighborhood by schools. Now I would never raise a child there. It's not conducive with what is good for a kid to have in their backyard. You know what I mean? It's constantly foul. There's constantly expletives. There's constantly people drinking.
According to their website, Scottsdale has around 3,600 short-term rental-only properties. Most owners pay a licensing fee to the city that amounted to $850,000 in 2024. According to the Scottsdale Progress, the city also receives more than $1 million a month in sales tax from the short-term renters themselves. Kate Bauer with the Neighborhood Alliance says she's been assisting city officials in other parts of the state to help reverse the effects of SB 1350, the state law that tied the hands of local governments to regulate such properties.
We've actually been working more with mayors from the rural towns of Arizona, and they're being decimated. Williams lost, you know, their HUD housing because so much housing turned short-term rental. Jerome has been decimated. Bisbee, Lake Havasu. They're now starting to put more pressure on state officials.
Bauer says she fully supports the right of residents to profit from their own properties, including benefiting from a newer Arizona law that allows homeowners in larger cities to build and rent out their on-property casitas.
That would be great. We would love to see, you know, more owner-occupied short-term rentals. The main problem is all of these full-time, for the most part, empty homes.
Empty except for when the partying never ends. In Scottsdale, Phil Latzman, KJZZ News.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. Anyone who has a pet knows these animal companions are a source of comfort and often a member of the family. For the unhoused population, pets can also be a lifeline. That's why one Arizona shelter has made veterinary services part of its care model. KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie takes us to one of the only animal clinics in the country on a shelter campus.
So we're doing a little toenail trim. Buddy got his vaccines already. He was so brave. He got his little dewormer and also his microchip.
Veterinarian Renee Fisher is treating Buddy, a teeny tiny black and white chihuahua puppy.
He got those chihuahua shakes. There's your last little snack. Good job, Buddy. You did it.
Buddy's owner, Matthew Diano, sits quietly in the corner of a small exam room inside the Marion and Bob RA Companion Animal Clinic. The clinic, which opened in July, is located on the campus of St. Vincent de Paul, a homeless shelter in South Phoenix where owners and pets can stay together. For Diano, this is more than just a vet visit.
It means a lot because he's going to serve as my emotional support animal.
Roughly one in five shelter residents who come through St. Vincent's has a pet. Diano used to be one of them. He recently moved into his own apartment after being unhoused for the last 7 years.
Now that I got the shots, I can finally feel, once I get the whole round, I'm going to feel more safer to bring him out. But before, I was a little anxious because of him possibly catching any parvo or anything that's out there.
Buddy is part of Diano's new start and hopefully a buddy for life. But vet care isn't cheap or readily available for this population. And if a shelter doesn't accept pets, that unhoused individual might forego help. Andrea Ariza works at St. Vincent de Paul. She says the clinic is connected to the 100-bed transitional shelter for older adults and people with disabilities.
That's actually a big reason why we started this, because many of the residents that we support have a pet, and for many of them, that's their only companion and their only family sometimes.
Another reason for having an on-site vet clinic? Access. Before building this 3,000-square-foot space, St. Vincent's partnered with other organizations to provide mobile vet care across the valley.
And a lot of our residents, they struggle to get there, either on the bus or it was just too hot to go outside with their pets. And then some pets, they have to walk with them so they don't have the dog booties to get there too. So many struggles.
Genevieve Frederick is the founder and president of Feeding Pets of the Homeless, a national organization that partners with 2,000 animal hospitals across the country to provide emergency vet care.
The average cost per pet is over $700.
And it's not getting cheaper. Nor is the need going away. She says homelessness rose by 18% between 2023 and 2024.
That's the increase. Along with those people, they're bringing their pets, and we estimate it's now 33% of homeless have pets.
Last year, Frederick's organization spent $1.1 million to provide more than 1,600 pets with emergency and follow-up care.
And that was after discounts.
There's also this sense of responsibility, she says, among this population to keep their pet healthy, despite facing tough circumstances day in and day out.
A lot of times we have homeless tell us that their pet is what has kept them going.
Back at St. Vincent's Animal Clinic, Renee Fisher, the vet treating Buddy, says the services he received, shots, nail trimming, and microchipping, would have cost upwards of $300 at a regular vet, something Buddy's owner couldn't afford. Here, it's free, and the plan is to keep it mostly that way. Cassie Boyle is a clinic coordinator at St. Vincent de Paul.
So our goal right now, the starter point is we have vaccines and some of the basic care. So eyes, ears, and skin issues. We've got medications that we can treat them while they're here or send owners home with a treatment plan.
Eventually, Boyle says, the clinic hopes to expand into more advanced services like spay and neuter surgeries, dental care, and x-rays. But all of that takes funding. In the meantime,
the big thing is vaccines, microchipping while they're here, so that way they can get into housing or get into shelters that require those vaccines.
And that's the end game here, to make sure both these pets and the people who love them have access to a safe and stable space until they can find their own place to call home. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Water officials in Tucson say the city has started receiving settlement funds from a class action lawsuit against major manufacturers of a firefighting foam that contains PFAS. The human-made chemicals don't break down naturally and are linked to cancer and other health issues. From the Fronteras desk in Tucson, KJZZ's Elisa Resnick has more.
A firefighting foam called AFFF that contains PFAS has been used for decades at military sites and airports, including in Tucson. The chemicals seeped into groundwater here and caused contamination. At the mayor and council meeting this week, Tucson Water Director John Kamik said Tucson is now receiving funds from a lawsuit against companies that produce products with PFAS, like 3M and DuPont.
Our first installment amounted to nearly $4.9 million, representing 20% of our anticipated share from the largest settlement pool.
Tucson has spent more than $50 million of its own money on PFAS remediation so far. Kamik says some two dozen wells remain shut off due to the contamination. Elisa Resnick, KJZZ News, Tucson.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. The Arizona Supreme Court has rejected a bid by state schools chief Tom Horn to keep one of its justices from deciding whether he can sue schools over English instruction. KJZZ's Greg Haney reports.
Horn argued Supreme Court Justice Bill Montgomery should not be able to hear his case over English immersion instruction. Lower courts have ruled Horn does not have the authority to sue schools, saying that power lies with the State Board of Education. In last week's filing, Horn said Montgomery accused him of breaking campaign finance laws 15 years ago when the justice was Maricopa County attorney. Montgomery reportedly let the other justices on the high court decide if he should recuse himself over the matter. The outcome of the legal challenge could change how students who don't speak English as a native language are taught in schools. Greg Haney, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Pancreatic cancer is one of the deadliest forms of cancer with a poor prognosis rate, but a new study suggests that a vaccine could help prevent recurrent cases of that disease. KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie has more.
Dr. Mittal Patel is a medical oncologist with Dignity Health Cancer Institute at St. Joseph's Medical Center. He says the early results of this phase one trial are promising.
And then when they started to look at the effect of it, the efficacy of it, followed these patients for 2.5 years, they saw that the patients who got the vaccine, their cancers came back less.
The overall survival rate of pancreatic cancer is anywhere between 10 and 13%, and it can reoccur, which makes the vaccine even more exciting.
A vaccine has always been reviewed as the Holy Grail.
The vaccine works by helping the immune system recognize and fight off proteins linked to the cancer. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This is the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast. And from KJZZ's original production, The Show, it's time for a Tiny Desert concert. Here's co-host Sam Dingman.
Today we're featuring a band called New Misphoria. New Misphoria is a two-piece ensemble featuring guitarist and lead singer Lee Parada and drummer Bella Crump. They joined us for an interview and performance at Stinkweed's record store. I began our conversation by asking Lee where she gets her ideas.
I don't really sit down to write. It's more of like a reaction to something happening in my life that feels like it needs the space to be processed.
Was music always the way that felt best to you to do that?
Yeah, I think so. I wrote one of my first songs when I was in fifth grade, and it was called Broken Hearted.
In fifth grade?
Yeah. Music has always been the way that I move through those feelings.
Tell me more about what you mean by that.
I get, like, I don't know, like, love feels like a song to me in and of itself. And I think when I experience, like, romance, good or bad, or everything in between, I can like hear the music I associate with those feelings like while it's happening. And so if it comes to an end, I like finally get to take all of what I heard in my head the whole time and like put it into words.
Oh my gosh. So it's is that a sense of comfort for you? Like the idea that no matter what happens, you know there's like a song that might come out of it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think it's okay if it doesn't go as I wanted it to, because it's an opportunity for me to grow into myself through my own art.
Wow. Can I ask you, if I may, at least in the songs that I have heard of yours so far, mm-hmm. in Acronym, you sing like very directly, I'm trying.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like trying and the sense of effort that love takes, that romance takes,
the uncertainty about whether to really like let yourself go with it or hold yourself back from it
mm-hmm.
seems consistent in your lyrics. Is that something you're thinking about consciously?
No, it's so conscious, and it's cool that you noticed that, because I think I have a habit of not always being able to go with the flow if it's like my heart on the line. And so when I talk about in that song specifically, like I'm trying, I think when I wrote that song, I was 19 and I'm 25 now. So it's been around for a long time. That was at a time that I really was trying to prove myself. And if you listen to kind of like the evolution of some of my lyrics, it changes and it becomes less of I'm trying to like, I tried, or like I gave it what I could, and I'm okay that like it didn't pan out.
Yeah. Bella, let me ask you, when you're gonna put drums to a song that Lee has written, well, actually, let me back up. Is that how it works?
Lee definitely comes to me with songs that she's written, and it is kind of a funny joke within our friend group that something happens in Lee's life and oh, there's gonna be a song about this. When Lee brings me a song, it's usually mostly finished, but we'll sort of work on little dynamics and intricacies of the instrumentals together.
Okay, well, so that makes me want to ask something, because something I'm always interested in when you see duos where it's just guitar and drums and vocals is that the drums are having to do this kind of interesting thing, in my opinion, and please tell me if you disagree, where you're obviously providing the rhythm, but in a way, you're also kind of a harmony instrument. Does it feel that way to you as you're doing it?
It definitely does feel that way. When I'm playing the drums, it's sort of like each specific drum in a drum kit that I'm using provides a certain timbre and a certain resonance that adds to each note and each chord. It definitely feels like it all comes as one once the drums are added. Drums are sort of like a form of meditation for me. I almost get like lost in them in a way when I'm doing it.
A form of meditation. Can you say more about that?
Absolutely. Each drum having a certain vibration sort of has an effect on my brain and my body that makes it feel like I'm almost transcending and being relieved of my anxieties.
So that reminds me of what you were saying, Lee, in your songwriting about how if you're going through a difficult experience, you know that there's a song that will come out of it that will kind of help you integrate it or process it. Can I ask you, in the vein of what Bella was just saying, something again that I noticed about your guys' songs is that on the guitar, you're mostly playing rhythm lines. You're not playing like big melodic lead lines.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And you guys leave a lot of space for Bella to kind of like move around the kit and create a kind of lead line sort of in the music. Was that something that was just there from the beginning, or have you kind of found that through collaboration, and how does it interact with your lyrics?
I think I used to write in a way that wasn't really considering anything else, which was great. You know, it's like, it's nice to just write totally intuitively, and I still do that in my own way, but now when I write, I'm always thinking of her, because I understand that her drums will form the song into what it is. I'm a very emotional drummer, I feel like, where you wouldn't think of drums as holding a lot of emotion, but I feel like Lee's music has really impacted the way I play as well.
All right, so we're gonna listen to one of your songs. What are you gonna play for us?
We're gonna play one of our songs called Reflective Skin.
Yeah. that now it's swarming up again. And I'm acting like I.
As I understand it, New Miss Foray was not always just the two of you. There were other members previously. Mm-hmm. I could imagine a scenario where a band that has, I don't know how many it was originally. Was it four?
Four.
Okay. I could imagine a band that has four people going down to two and then thinking like, all right, well, we got to find two more people. In your guys' case, you were like, I think we've actually found our right number.
Yeah.
What was that realization?
Not that this is like a bad thing in any way, but the previous two members were both men, and I think that so much of what I write about, especially in the vein of like romantic experiences as a woman, is so unique to my experience as a woman, and having men in the band made me feel sometimes misunderstood, and not because I was being misunderstood, but I was like, this is like this thing that you could never really relate to, and a lot of my music is about feeling mistreated by men in my life, and having just another woman on my team made me feel like it's like, yeah, this feels right, because it's just you and I experiencing music as women.
That's a good point. I feel like once it was just the two of us, we kind of had to learn how to like fill space a little bit. We were able to kind of guide each other.
Yeah. Also having you, I don't think it's about necessarily being a duo. I think it's about being us.
This duo.
Yeah, couldn't imagine it being something that could be like accessed just by being in a two-piece. It's that like I am encouraged to experience my life through music because of Bella. I feel things really heavily, and I know that Bella does too, and I think that as two people who like really experience the weight of the world in like a very real way, the dynamics come from the safety to experience everything through each other.
So there's a lyric, I'm trying but I had to restart, they never told me love would be so hard, something like that.
They never told me growing up would be so hard.
I apologize.
Yeah. No, that's fine.
Based on what you said about having music as this kind of like emotional backstop or like safety net, I could imagine a scenario where a songwriter like yourself might be worried about what would happen if like a relationship goes well, or like something happens in life that you don't need the music to salvage the experience, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Is that something you're concerned about? Is that something you think about?
All the time. All the time. It's so real. I write about heartbreak and like turmoil. That's my thing. And when I've been in really beautiful relationships where I didn't feel like I needed that outlet, I stopped writing music. Yeah, I think about that all the time, and it's been a very real thing of like, oh, I can't write because nothing is going wrong. Oh my God. Yeah.
Well, thank you both so much for talking to us. What are you going to take us out on?
We're going to play you out on our song called Acronym.
Hey, when you look at me, like I'm a
criminal or junkie.
This has been the Stories You Don't Want to Miss podcast, made possible in part by the Helios Education Foundation, Alliance Bank, the Vitalist Health Foundation, the Intel Corporation, Beach Fleischman, the Arizona Community Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thank you for listening and for your generous support. I'm Bridget Dowd. This is KJZZ. Listen more, learn more, online and on the KJZZ mobile app.